want fish, 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 fishing. I'm going fishing, hook, sinker, and line.
Yes, indeed, boys and girls. A little hook, sinker, line, it all just works out to be Fish and Frank here again. Yes, unfortunately, you tuned into that channel this time, this place, you know, and you got me again. I don't know if it's lucky, unlucky, but it's the truth. I'm here. I'm pretty sure that's correct. Yes, I'm who I think I am, aren't I, Robert?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, well, Robert's there. Good morning, afternoon, evening, something, RJ.
It's afternoon, I believe.
Okay, afternoon. And we're live on the big WKDW here in Northport, Florida, extending out for miles and miles and miles and worldwide
across the world, yes. 52 countries listen to us.
Really?
52 countries. I don't know what's wrong with the other three, but maybe they don't have radio or internet, yeah.
Yeah. To the most pressing question of the day, we spent days and weeks with cold and windy and rainy and weird and all this, so everybody's stopping and going, what's going on out in the Gulf? What's happening in the Gulf? That, I mean, constant questions about it, and we finally have a little bit of answers, I think.
A lot of answers.
Okay, well, Robert, fill us in on the Gulfito de Mexico.
Nice. The wind finally died. Weather got, air temperature got warm. So it made it pretty feasible to go out in just about any boat right now.
I even
now,
did the whole hold my hands up like I'm shooting a shotgun when I did that.
That was pretty
killing
good.
The wind.
That was pretty good.
You did it, Robert.
Scatter
gun. It was your against the wind dance that did that.
Yeah.
You ought to see him. He's got a loincloth, headdress, feathers, the whole bit. He's out there in the backyard.
It worked.
He can
keep
stop
doing
that
it.
Wind.
I don't care what the neighbors say. Just keep it up, man.
Well,
it's a nice break, that's for sure.
The visuals are just not really what they should be, though.
Yeah, no.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Loincloth.
There's been the snapper, grunts, and porgies have been incredible from 5 miles to 15 miles out, especially some really nice quality sheep's head. You know, if you're going to go out there and just kind of play around, if you got friends or family that are not the best anglers, but you want to introduce them to fishing, that's a great way to do it.
And, you know, I was looking on the website today, fishandfranks.com, and on the reefs page. I think Mary's is 2.75 miles from land.
Yeah.
That's not even like the middle of the harbor.
Right.
You're further from land if you're in the middle of the harbor. So it's a very easy run out there. You go on fishandfranks.com, and then you click the maps of where to go fishing, and then roll down until you see reefs and wrecks. Click that. I have little things from Bell Grand Pass. It shows you how far out the reef is. I do it from Gasparilla Pass, Bell Grand Pass, some of them are from Stump Pass, depending upon where they are. But some of these reefs, there's reefs within 5 miles of shore, and sheephead are kind of a gulf fish. They kind of spawn, and they have young ones up here in the harbor and stuff, but they like being in the reefs in the Gulf of Mexico. It's actually more of a reef fish than it would be a harbor fish.
Right. You know, they like being around that submerged structure with all the little bugs and critters that are on it. You know, that's their primary food source is some kind of crustacean, so.
So we think of them as a pier fishing or bridge fishing fish, but really they're more of a reef fish. So if right now the spawn is just kind of concluding, and there's still a few fish in and out with the spawn and all that coming in and out of there, but between areas like the Placida Trestle and out onto some of those near reefs, you figure if a fish swims 3 miles an hour, that's a moderate walk for a human. And I think fish can easily travel much faster than that.
Well, absolutely.
It's literally an hour, less than an hour from where they're at inside, doing the spawning, mating thing, going out to some of these reefs. They can be from those reefs into the intercoastal waterway in an hour or so of casual swimming.
Yeah.
So you know, the reason I'm bringing this up is because people think, well, they're here, how are they going to get way out there? That's way out there. Well, if a fish swims at 2 miles an hour for 2 hours, and all he's got to do for all day is swim around. So if he just decides I'm going to swim in that direction for 2 hours, he's 4 miles away. That's at 2 miles an hour.
Well, people tend to relate everything from a human perspective, so they don't stop and examine it from an animal perspective.
Well, I would say from a modern human perspective. If this was 75 years ago...
I have a goldfish.
You could walk, you know, you would walk across town, you would park your car, walk all over town, and come back to your car. Now people want to pull up immediately in front of the store. If...
I got to go those all the way over there.
Get a fake handicap sticker.
Yeah. And they won't park at the back of the lot. I always park at the very end of the lot. A, my truck doesn't get hit. B, I don't mind the walk. You know, right. I could use the exercise. So I just park at the back of the lot where nobody parks and walk into the store, walk back out. I don't think it's a big deal, but I watch people drive round and round and round and round waiting to get one of the first two or three parking spots. And by that time, I've already parked, been in the store, I come back out, they're still driving around. So I'm going to say it's from a modern human perspective.
Right.
Not from a 50- or 75-year-old human perspective. But these reefs also have a lot of mangrove snappers, because mangrove snappers grow up in the harbor, and the first places they stop are on these reefs right there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, then you have the subadult mangrove snapper, you have the sheep's head, but you know, the weird part is, just like we talk about adult snook staying up in the rivers and up in the canals sometimes for several years, sometimes snook never leave those reefs. There's times where they're out there for a full year and never get bothered by anything, or just don't move because it's perfectly comfortable for them.
Novak, Marys, Trembly, there's so many of them right there that every diver that goes down with a camera, you see schools of snook on these reefs.
In January and February.
We're talking some big animals, too, that you see on the reefs. They're not the snook you catch in the harbor that are a couple of pounds. I mean, there's some big...
20, 30, 40-pound snook out
That's
there.
Right. They're big, big animals in there.
But it's amazing how many snook are on these near reefs. And if you lived in Marco Island and you fish down there, or like Estero and Marco Island, your primary snook fishing for a lot of these guys is out on these reefs. And they catch a lot of snook down there. People don't target them, trying to get them... It's going to kind of be best almost with a porgy rig, because they're not on the bottom. They're not bottom feeding there. They're not up by the top. They're literally 5-8 feet off the bottom. And so you would have to put a weight on, come up about 5 feet, put a little float there, come off of that with another 5-foot leader, and put a bait on. You know, so it's up there. And probably another little tiny float off your hook to keep it out. So
yeah, I would say that would be one good way to do it. Because, I mean, I've seen it done so many different ways, but it's usually summertime when I see
May and June is when you're going to get massive amounts of snook on these reefs. Because snook need to spawn, and May and June is the primary spawning months. And they need to spawn in salt water. Because of the buoyancy of the salt water, it floats their eggs up, the eggs become part of the plankton, and on incoming tides, they follow the tides in to get back into the harbor. But
not only that, they also have that food source out there, you know, in the summertime, so that's why they move out there.
Well, you know. Snook, right now you're going to start seeing them really keying in on greenbacks, thread fins, any type of the small bait fish like that, the white bait, ladyfish, you know, anything in that kind of similar pattern. They're very oily little fish. But in order to understand why, you've got to go back a few years in history. And all these modern day idiots who, okay, we don't want that statue up, or we don't want this, they don't want to know where they started from. And what they do is they go out and they'll end up right back where they were, because everything goes around the circle unless you know where you started from and where you're at now. Then you can go away from that. But back in 1968, Zapata Foods, the Bush family company, did a survey. A guy by the name of Mike Mack flew the airplane. This is before satellites and all this. They literally flew airplanes out with cameras on the airplanes, and they would take pictures and write down what was happening. They left Naples and flew along the coast from Naples to Tampa and marking what they saw. And what it was a continuous school of bait fish. Butterfish, greenbacks, threadfins, skipjacks, whatever. Continuous from Naples all the way up to Tampa, never less than a quarter mile wide. So there was solid bait fish along the coast. And at no point did it get to be less than a quarter mile wide. At some points, according to Mike Mack, it was a mile plus wide of schools of bait fish. Now you transpose that today, a big school of bait fish is 10 by 20 foot. You think that's a big school. Well, this literally covered the entire coast. What they did was they sent boats from Texas over here, just like the shrimping fleets come right now. Right now, if you go out in the Gulf of Mexico, you will see shrimp boats from almost every state in the Gulf, Texas, Louisiana, all them, because their shrimping is closed. So they're coming here to make money off of the shrimp here. And if Florida closed its shrimping the same way they do in Texas and Louisiana and all the rest of them, we would have more fish because they would have more food. But they came here, they loaded their boats up, almost sunk their boats getting them full of this stuff, and they use it for, you know, like the fish sticks and the fish patties, and they do the oil and they sell the bones for cattle feed. It's actually not, if you look at it from what they use versus what they throw out, they pretty much use everything they get in there.
Right, there's minimal waste
processed,
involved.
But it's maximum capture. But if you take, that went on, the bait fish schools were there really through the late 70s into the early 80s, and then it started getting really thin by the time of the middle 80s, late 80s. I remember there's big schools down there, a mile by a half a mile schools of bait, 2 miles by a mile, but not unbroken anymore. But then you come to now where there is no bait. But if you think about it, for all of the time a snook has been on the planet, those schools of bait fish were all along the coast. And when they would go to spawn, that's what they would go out to eat when they spawned. So for probably millions of years, snook left the harbor, the creeks, and all this kind of stuff, went along the beach, and fed on these type of fish. And it's highly probable that they need the oils after doing it for eons. That oil may help with their reproduction somehow. Or maybe it's just habit, and or maybe it is an urge that they want that bait fish because it's getting close to spawn time. So now this year the water is coming up, what, about 8-10 degrees by the end of this week, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, since the last cold front last week, it's definitely come up at least 6 to 8 degrees right now. By the end of this week, it wouldn't surprise me if it came up another 6 to 8 degrees.
So we're going to get, we're hearing stories of schools of tiny bait fish coming around.
Yeah, there's been a lot of little fry. You know, you can generalize them as glass minnows or white bait or whatever you want, but it's just small, unidentifiable fish unless you're an ichthyologist.
So it could be mullet, it could be greenbacks, threadfins, glass minnows, butterfish, skipjacks. It could be any number of small schooling fish.
Right.
So, I mean, for all we know, they could be mackerel.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, because they're literally 1 to 2 inches long, the vast majority of them. So
now,
some
isn't
of them have
there mackerel
glass
following
minnows.
Those in some places?
The only ones I've heard about have been in Sarasota.
So
I haven't heard of anything down this area.
So Sarasota's actually got mackerel coming in on the bait fish.
Correct.
That means Sarasota Bay and the waters off there are warm enough right now, at least near the surface, to have mackerel coming back.
Yeah, which is good because, I mean, our mackerel season this year was obviously horrible for multiple reasons.
But so to me, mackerel season starts in the spring. I usually don't start looking for mackerel till April, May, and that's when I really want to see the mackerel come in by May, because that's going to bring in the small sharks. The water temperature normally is 74 degrees-ish by then.
Oh, at least, yeah.
So it's plenty warm enough. Mackerel like that warmer, you know, high 70s to 80 degree water. That's when they want to come in.
Yeah.
So the Spanish are still not going to be there yet, but you're going to start looking for white bait right now if you want to catch a whole bunch of snook. Yeah, a whole bunch of little snook. The shrimp, which has been the best bait for the last few weeks, the last few months, shrimp was number one. It was king. There was nothing going to topple its reign of power because the water was so cold.
Right.
Now, it's a digestive thing, right, Robert?
I think that's a huge part of it is, you know, when the water temperature gets too cold, because, I mean, people forget that all fish are cold-blooded, so they need to warm up in order to digest their food. And shrimp
without
just
some warmth, they just, the food can rot before they expel it.
Right. And since shrimp don't have, like, the bones, all they really have is an exoskeleton, which can break down really easily with the enzymes in their stomach, it's a fast process to get it in, turn it into energy, and expel it out of there.
Yeah, so they can eat a shrimp, digest it, get some proteins and vitamins, whatever, off of it, and expel the waste without having to worry so much about it rotting or spoiling and actually poisoning them before it can be digested, where a baked fish might be, or a crab or something like that.
Right, something with much denser bones or even just much denser skin tissue.
Scales, whatever, yeah. Bones. So right now that water's getting warmer, the fish are starting to feed, so white bait is actually, or greenbacks or threadfins or whatever you want to call them, some type of small bait fish, is actually going to start to be a much better bait. This is the time of year when you want to start looking for that stuff. We're right on the cusp.
Right.
So shrimp are still working really well. It's the beginning of what you would call the white bait season.
No.
Almost.
No, because we say it all the time. January is not January, February is not February. What happens this year is not the same that's going to happen next year or last year or anything like that. It's water temperature. So as long as the water temperatures are staying where it's at, yes, we'll see some of the white bait and see it be more active. But if we get another significant cold front and that water temperature drops, that's going to change their food habits all over again.
Okay, but maybe for this week, with the way the water's getting warmer, 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 if you can find some bait fish, this would be a good week to try it.
Sure.
If we get another cold front, it's a waste of effort.
Right.
Because once that water gets down, you're not going to catch fish with them anyway, so why bother?
Yeah.
So this week, trout. Everybody's asking about trout. They say, there's no trout here, there's no trout here. But we know that the trout have been laying right on the bottom around the Tom Adams Bridge. They've been laying on the bottom throughout the intercoastal. Mm-hmm. And places where we never suspected they would be.
Right.
I didn't think of it. I know you didn't.
No.
You know, RJ, I'm sure, was the same way as us. Well, we don't see them. They're not here. But the truth of the matter is, they were hiding much deeper than we ever dreamed and doing something we didn't dream they would do. They were hiding from those way more than normal cold water temperatures on the bottom in 10 feet of water.
Absolutely.
Hugging that bottom, doing their thing down there, just kind of waiting it out. And now with this water, I'm going to bet that today, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, every day there's going to be more trout on the flats. There's going to be more trout where people want to go find trout, Bull Bay, Turtle Bay. Nobody's thinking that let's go, you know, on the intercoastal and drop a bait on the bottom and look for trout.
No. No, it'd be the last place you'd think to look.
I mean, it's not something ever dawned on me. So what do you think, RJ? We know they've been hiding down there. I believe as we get these few degrees warmer, every day those flats where people would normally look for trout, they should be going back to where they're supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that the fish are going to move back to their most comfortable environment. And for trout, it has always been the flats and the grass beds and things like that, where when the water gets as cold as it has gotten, I agree, they go down to the bottom where at least the temperature is going to stay the same. They're relatively safe down there. They're not as exposed to other predators, and they can just kind of hang out, like you said, and be opportunistic in what they're going to eat instead of being out foraging like you normally see them.
So the good news, boys and girls, is we have figured out there's several reefs very close to shore, within 3 miles-ish, 3 to 4 miles. You can still see land. Make sure, though, one thing you always want to do if you're heading into the Gulf of Mexico, have an old-fashioned compass. I don't care about your GPS. I don't care about all that. A compass keeps you safe. Unless you drop it and smash it, it's going to work, regardless if there's electricity in the boat, if the fuse blew, if the wire burned. You have a compass there, you can go, okay, there's east, that's the way land is. You know, you never know. You get just a little bit further out than what you think, and you're out of sight of land, and what happens if the GPS quits? I've had my GPSs stop working in the harbor. I'm like, damn, the wire went bad, something went out. I don't know how to
fix
it.
And sometimes the satellites burp and your GPS goes down, and it takes, you know, an hour or so for it to accumulate the right satellites again. I agree. And then the other thing, too, is it's real simple. Here in Florida, the coast is generally going north to south. So if it's towards the afternoon, it's like 1 o'clock or later, and you want to go home, you put the sun at your back because it's setting in the west.
Yep.
And that's how you get home.
But you've got to wait for the afternoon.
You may not come in where you expect you're going to come in, but you're going to come in.
For the $20 it costs to get a halfway decent compass showing you north, south, east, and west, you got to go east to go home, boys and girls. That's simple as it is.
And the other thing,
the sun to your back.
That's right, put the sun to your back. The other thing is the Coast Guard Auxiliary regularly has classes in compass navigation and using charts and all the rest. They're usually free. Call up your local Coast Guard Auxiliary, find out when they have the classes. It's a wonderful piece of information to have, especially now you're in a thunderstorm and it's raining and you don't know where the sun is and the wind is blowing and you're starting to panic. This is the kind of stuff will get you home, because the compass works whether it rains or not, whether there's a sun or not. So I agree with Frank on that. In fact, I've been kidding people because I have zero sense of direction. My gene pool would have died out except for the invention of the compass.
Well, I can honestly...
Got us all home every now and then when we needed to get home.
Well, you're Irish, so it wasn't the compass that saved you. It was the whiskey that punished you. God invented whiskey so Irish wouldn't take over the world.
Right.
It allowed you to stay home and not feel bad about it.
That's right. Exactly right.
Anyway, what's going on the flats? We're going to start seeing the fishing return to what you would think as normal Florida fishing. You go back in the flats and find your fish. You're not going to have to go out deep and look for them. But there's more going out in the Gulf than what we talked about. What's the grouper, amberjack? What's going on out there?
Yeah, depending on who you talk to, from 70 to about 110 feet of water is where all of your bigger red grouper are being caught. And it just seems like one person does phenomenal, another two people don't, and then five guys do really well. So there's no go north or go south or go just due west. You're going to have to pick and choose your spots. But honestly, always with fishing, especially offshore, I always start at my farthest point that I'm expecting to go and then work my way back in to see where I can find those fish.
And I'm the opposite because I'm cheap. I start at my closest number, see if I've got anything, and if I can catch the fish I want there, I don't have to go all the way out. But it's a difference in how you think about it, whether you're starting at your closest numbers and then working your way out. But a lot of times it depends on what time you get out there, too. Right. If you really want to go out to 100 feet of water, you need to do that right away, because if you spend an hour or two messing around, you might not have time to get out there and get back. But me, I always opt out for the cheap one first. Why spend the gas if I can find it closer?
Right.
But
and there's some good truth to that, but the only reason why I personally do it is just because of you have the afternoon sea breeze, time can sometimes be short, and rather than making myself trying to get out further into a headwind, it's nice to come back with those following seas when I'm coming back. It just makes it a little nicer.
Okay. All right, so what Robert's saying is kind of time constraint. If you stop on your way out, you're probably going to be hitting sea breezes and all that. You're going to end up being out a lot longer than you want to.
Right.
Let's see. What's going on the ICW right now?
Well, I mean, basically that's your next place to fish.
Intercoastal waterway. That's between the Barrier Islands and the mainland. A little bit of water that goes all the way up. Everybody says, what's the ICW? I'm like, really? The English language has failed. I asked a person in a convenience store one day, why is the flag at half-mast? What? I had no idea what half-mast was. ICW, the Intercoastal Waterway. Sorry.
Basically, that's the next best place to be fishing just because, you know, the Gulf right now is beautiful, lots of species of fish. Well, for the last 2 months, the best fishing has been along the Intercoastal. Whether you're fishing the mangroves, the canals, boat docks, oyster bars, little creeks, that's where your better concentration of fish has been, whether it's sheep's head, whether it's trout, snook, redfish, even some mangrove snapper, a few pompano, and even been
black
some
drum.
Schools of permit out there, black drum, yeah. I mean, basically, just about anything that you could think of that is normally available in the wintertime in decent numbers is all down there along that intercoastal.
And we've speculated on that last week and all kinds of things. And it could be something as simple as the shrimp migration moving out, and the ICW has stuff that is hard to find. Very deep water in the channel, very shallow water next to it. And then on the backside of Gaspereau Island, you've got all of these docks there that are prime fish habitat. And they don't get a lot of pressure because people are usually driving to the flats and going here and going there, because why would you want to go fish a dock when you can go fish mangroves?
Right.
The scenery's better. It's more serene. But all of a sudden, everybody found them this year. They're going to the docks, they're fishing under them, and whether the docks are half or three-quarters of a mile away from the intercoastal, again, if a fish in a half, fish swimming at 3 miles an hour to go a half a mile, that's 20, 30 minutes of swim. So all of a sudden it starts getting cold, they just swim back, drop down into deep water. It doesn't take that much.
No, not at all.
They'll easily move a quarter mile, half mile from the ICW up into the shallows, go up around the docks, go back at night.
Yeah, they're going to feed, and you know they're real slow going in the morning to come out, but on their once nighttime starts to come in or evening comes in, they've already warmed up all day, so they're a lot more active. So they swim back to that spot faster than they did getting there.
Well, I think fish easily swim at 10 miles an hour. So in a half an hour, they can go 5 miles.
You know, right, yeah.
That's a no-brainer. But where I would say the best trout fishing is what, in the southern part of the harbor right now?
Yeah, the southern part, like Pine Island, has been where I've been getting some of my better reports on some better fish, like the 16 to 20, 21-inch range. Guys are actually sight fishing them a little bit, too, in the late mornings, early afternoons. They're just seeing them sitting out there drifting over some of the sand holes. You just got to be real vigilant to watch, because the one guy I was talking to yesterday who came for our seminar, he's from Cape Coral and fishes a lot. And he said those fish have been sitting real still almost the way snook do. And if you're not paying attention to it, you'll all of a sudden drift right up on top of them and blow them right out. And then you have no chance of catching them.
So you really kind of... It would almost be better if you had like one of those pole anchor things with the button on it, so you
right.
Go about 10 feet, stop, cast for a while, go about 10 feet, stop, cast for a while,
yeah,
or maybe 20 feet. I don't know. Let's say you're casting 30 feet, so probably, I guess, a 20-foot jump each time would be okay. That way you'd have 10 feet of your old cast and 20 feet of a new cast.
Right.
So you want to go about two-thirds of the distance you cast every time you pull the anchor and move forward. In that kind of conditions, that's what I would do. whether you have a manual stick and anchor pin where you just shove it in the ground and then lift it up, give yourself a little push, go about 20 feet, stick it back in, and then go back up, cast that whole front again, and then kind of like I would work a pier. I'm going to walk out right at the start of the pier, start casting right along the pilings, go to the next set of pilings, keep casting and casting, and then go to the next set of pilings and keep casting and casting. That way I covered the whole darn pier. I didn't miss anything.
Right.
But if you just walk out, cast here, then you walk there, cast there, you miss that one 10-foot spot where the fish work.
And it doesn't take much for that. You know, like you said, 10 feet is a huge, huge area for those fish to be. I mean, if you have a subtle 6-inch drop-off in that 10-foot spot, that's that perfect water temperature for them, or a perfect ambush spot for them.
Current flow, something.
Current. I mean, current's been a huge thing. You know, talking to some of the captains and some of our regular customers, they're catching trout in the morning and then going out the next day, same weather, same tides, no trout to be caught, but then catching them in the afternoon. You know, they're switching roles, you know, same way with the sheep's head. The sheep's head are there, and then all of a sudden they just completely shut down, and then they have to go move around a little bit. You know, these anyone who's being successful out there with their fishing right now is jumping. You know, they're not, like you said, you know, pull your anchor, drift 20 feet, sit down again, or use your trolling motor, or flat out just drift and see what you can start picking up. And when you start to hit a fish, maybe set your anchor down, fish it for a little bit, nothing happens, move again.
Well, it kind of falls in love with, don't fall in love with where you put your anchor down.
What if I bring my mailbox?
Down, yeah, you got to bring a mailbox, set it up, get ready to move into that spot, because once you drop the anchor, that's where you're going to live. I got my mailbox up, I'm getting Reader's Digest, it's all good. This is a nice place to be. Guy was asking me about fishing the reef. I said, well, you use a bobber, right? He's like, well, no, I'm bottom fishing. I said, well, I don't mean for fishing. You can put the bobber out, put a bait on it 3 or 4 feet down, but when I get to a place like a reef and I'm going to put my anchor down, first thing I want to do is cast the line out that has a bobber on it of some kind. And if I got the time, I'll actually lay the rod tip by the water so the line is in the water, not affected by the wind. I watch where that bobber goes. Now, if it's mild wind, mild current, I'll just throw it out, set it in the rod holder while I get my stuff ready. But it's the first thing I want to do, because I might cast the line out, but I'm looking at that bobber, and it appears like I'm anchored and the current and everything is going off kind of my left at a 30-degree angle, but all of a sudden I look at the bobber and it's way off to my right, 90 degrees away from where I think I'm fishing. So you have apparent current and what looks like the water's doing from being above it, and then you have what the water's actually doing underneath. So if you didn't fall in love with that spot you dropped the anchor, you can pull the anchor up, reposition the boat so that when you're fishing, your baits and lines are going over what you want them to go over. Not throwing them out and going, oh my gosh, they're all heading the other way. No wonder the fish aren't finding it, because they can't smell my bait, because they're way up current from where I cast. So if you can get up current from them where they can actually smell your bait, now you got a shot at catching a fish.
Right. And people don't, you know, the biggest thing is you got to observe things, you know, and the bobber is by far the best way to see how those currents are going. You know, an example is behind my house. You know, I live next to the bridge, and when the tide is coming in, it creates an eddy, both in and out, and the eddy is that the current actually swirls in at all times rather than moving with the tide. If the tide's coming in, I still got an eddy that pulls water in front of the boat, but it'll circle a little bit as it gets closer to my seawall and come back at me. And on an outgoing tide, it's flat out just the entire wall, the width of my dock, which is, what, 20 feet wide, is always coming in, even though it's the opposite of the main channel of the tide.
So the water's going up, actually probably hitting the bridge embutment where the bridge narrows down. And as that water's trying to get through, a portion of it is being sheared off and redirected backwards along your dock.
Yep.
So while out in the middle of the canal, you've got the tide going out along that seawall next to the bridge, the tide is actually like it was sliced off and being curved back.
And it's strong enough where it actually goes beyond my neighbor's dock. So average yard width is what, 80?
Yeah, about 80 feet.
So 160 feet this thing is traveling.
Yeah, well, the stronger the tide, the further the backwash would be. The slower the tide, the less the backwash would
be. I've never seen it anywhere close to being inside of his dock. It's always past his dock, no matter the tide. So it's just kind of interesting how little structures or big structures can totally change currents. So having that bobber out there, you got an old mangrove bush underwater from, say, a hurricane that you don't see is redirecting that current. Or standing on one of the piers, if you're a land-based fisherman, you got the water hitting those pilings around those docks or whatever, causes some swirling action. You've mentioned it millions of times with the, you fish a dock, you've got all these broken pilings under the water that you can't see.
I was wondering what I mentioned all the time. I never know.
Well, Placida trestle's over 100 years old. It's an old railroad trestle. They didn't take the old pilings out and put new ones in. They just put new ones in right next to the old ones. So there's pilings down there that are 2 inches exposed out of the sand to 4 feet exposed out of the sand, but are still a foot to 6 feet under the water. That creates all sorts of weird little currents and swirls that can change things.
Oh, absolutely.
To go back to offshore, when you fish the reef, you know, the primary rules for me is first you got to locate the reef. Right? So GPS or, you know, whenever you're going to get there, you're going to find it with your bottom machine. You find the reef. Now you got to figure out which way is the current towards the bottom going, not what's going on the top, because a lot of that's influenced by wind, and sometimes the currents are just moving in opposite directions. And the old-timers just take a bleach bottle with a weight on the bottom, but not enough of a weight to hold the bleach bottle where it needs to be. And they would toss it over, and they'd just kind of idle and see which way it's going, which way is the bottom pulling the old bleach bottle. And then you would go upstream, and you would toss your baits out over the side of the boat so that everything is going towards the reef. Because what a lot of guys do, and I've seen this, they'll get over the reef, they're right over the top of the reef, and they'll drop their baits, and of course the currents are taking it away from the reef, so now they're only catching the smaller fish that stay out on the outer edges of the reef, or they're not catching anything at all because their baits aren't getting anywhere near the reef.
And you see that a lot with people fishing the reef, because it'll look like they'll find it on their bottom machine, and then they'll go anchor up, and the boat swings around on the anchor.
Which has to do with the wind now, not the current.
Right, but they go through, oh, caught a fish, and then they wait, and the boat swings back, and oh, caught a fish.
Exactly right.
It's kind of a weird thing to play with. And believe it or not, sometimes you can correct some of that by how you position your outboard. An outboard on a powerboat actually acts like a rudder on a sailboat. I use it all the time when I'm drifting to kind of steer me in the direction I want to go during a drift. And sometimes when I'm anchored, I find if I turn the wheel one way, I can hold myself better against the current on one port rather than going back and forth. You're going back and forth a lot, and your motor's all the way to the right. Try to straighten it out. If your motor's already straight, try turning it to one side or another to lessen the amount of back and forth that you get.
Yeah, it's acting like a little bit of a drag, and then it also catches that, like a, you know, like you said, like a rudder, but it also can catch the wind and slow things down and change angle too.
And again, the basic concept is you got to get the bait to the fish. What are you doing to get the bait to where the fish is? Otherwise, you're not fishing, you're just drowning a piece of bait.
And not falling in love with a spot is kind of critical. Now, if you're going to go back on the flats right now and you're looking for snook or redfish, you're going to be going back, and it's kind of the same thing as when you're drifting. You're going to pick a likely-looking shoreline, but at this time of year, you got to stay back to where you can barely cast to it. normally, when I'm fishing the mangroves, I have a six and a half foot rod I like to use. But at this time of year, I'm going to be doing a 7.5, maybe even an 8 foot rod, something that I can really cast the long distance, because I'm going to be back twice as far as I normally am off of the mangroves. A, the water's clear, but B, when you have these cooler, chillier water temperatures, quite often the fish are not up in the shade. They're not right up under the mangroves. They're going to be out 5, 10, 15 feet in front of the mangroves, maybe being able to run back to hide in the roots if a big predator comes along or whatever. But you have a 50-50 shot. Are they going to be up under the trees, or are they going to be out just in front of the trees enjoying the sunshine and, you know, laying up in little troughs or holes? And if you pull up a normal distance, you scared the fish out of that trough.
Right.
So using a much longer rod right now is critical. I'll use a casting bubble if I have to get my bait all the way up there. But I want to toss a shrimp, not a particularly big one, but, you know, medium big, I guess the best way to say it. Something about, if I laid it across my palm, it would be about the length of the shrimp would be about the width of my hand, and not including the thumb. Tail hook it, and if you tail hook a shrimp, go side to side or bottom to top with your hook right by the tail, all of the weight is at the forward part. And so when you throw it, it's going to cast straight like a missile. You're going to get 30% further on your cast. Now, the bad part about it is when fish eat shrimp, they swallow them head first. So when you feel the bite, you got to go 1, 2, then set the hook or be prepared for the fish. If you hook them in the head, you feel the bite, you get on the hook set immediately because they're going to swallow it from the head. So as soon as you feel that first bite, they've got that head.
Right.
But if you hook a shrimp through the head and you cast it, it tumbles end over end through the air, creating a lot of drag friction, and the wind will blow it back at you. Where if you tail hook it, it throws the way it's supposed to throw, weight forward, and you can get 20-30% farther out of a cast. But by using a longer rod with a little bit of a light tip on it, but heavy backbone like the ultra fast tapers, you can get that little whip when you come back and zing that rod forward to cast. You're going to get that little crack of the whip action off that light tip, the good solid pull of the stiff rod, and that shrimp's going to fly far enough for you. It's a booger, because casting 60-80 feet is tough.
With any kind of accuracy, too.
Yeah. So you're trying to get right up along the drip edge of the mangroves. And that far back, I'm not trying to get under them or anything, but I want to hit the drip edge, right where the rain, the very edge of the mangroves are. And I'm going to let that bait sit there. And it's going to sit there and sit there until I can't stand it. And then I'm going to start pulling it out a little bit, but I'm only going to go out about 2-3 feet. And then I just let it sit again for a while. And when I can't stand that, I bring it in another few feet and let it sit there a while. Because I want to fish from that drip edge out 15-20 feet off the mangroves, because right now a lot of guys are hitting those fish there.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're paying real close attention, you said earlier, you know, the water is super clear out there, so watch, you know, pay attention to where you're casting at and work that lure real slow. And sometimes you may not see the fish immediately, but as you're working that bait, you might see that fish turn subtly to watch your bait go by, but it still might be too chilly for him to want to swim 5 feet after that bait. So, you know, in your next cast, you can try to reposition it to move it just a little bit closer to him where he might come over and hit it.
Now, doing this requires accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you grab your fishing pole, put your middle, your little finger and your ring finger behind the stem of the reel, put your middle finger and index finger in front of the stem of the reel. And with a spinning rod, you have a reel seat where it clamps to the rod and a stem coming down. You want two fingers on each side of that stem. Now, what that's going to do is allow you to index the way that, where that reel is. Like when you're trying to use a knife or a sword, if the handle is oval-shaped or a little longer, you know where the blade is. Now, by grabbing that with two fingers on each side of the stem, you can index where the bottom of the reel is, so you know where you got it. You put your thumb straight up the rod.
That's now, a really important point. Don't wrap your thumb around the rod because you're going to, depending whether you're left-handed or right-handed, if you wrap around with your right hand, it's going to go to the left.
Yep.
It's going to go where your thumb points. That's the rule.
That's
point
the key.
The thumb, that's where the bait is going to go or your lure is going to go. So if you put it straight up, you're going to get a straight cast.
And that's exactly perfect because if you have your hand wrapped around it, your thumb is always pointing to that other side. So you're going to, unconsciously, you're going to cast that way. If you want to see what we're talking about, you're sitting around, you know, make sure people really can't see. You don't want to look like you're insane or anything. But point your thumb up in the air for a second, you know, make a thumbs up signal. And then pick a, like say, a lamp in the room and just point your thumb quickly at the lamp. And then come back and point your thumb at something else. You can incredibly pick a direction with your thumb. It's really accurate. And old gunfighters would lay their index finger along the side of a gun. It got burned a lot because when the black powder went off, that was where your finger was, but it would tell them the direction of the barrel because your fingers are attached to you. You get used to pointing them. And if it came down to a matter of a burnt finger or being killed in a gunfight, the burnt finger was preferable.
Mm-hmm.
So you could lay that finger along the gun pointing at your opponent, and that was the best way to aim fast. But now, with the fishing pole, I put my thumb straight up the rod, and this works great with an overhand cast. Watch out your wrist does not cock over to the side. Most people want to lay that wrist over, and they're kind of throwing in this weird sideways wrist movement. Bring your arm straight up, keep your wrist straight, your thumb straight out the rod, and just shoot forward with it, pointing that way. And you can get to just the left of where that snook is laying, or just to the right of where that snook is laying, or right on top of it. Most people, when they cast, they're pretty good and they get real close, but it's not exactly where they want all the time. It's more luck than technique.
Yeah, I've had more bad casts off to the right side or the left side than I've had good ones.
Yeah, it's all about getting that thumb up the rod. And when you go to cast, you come back on the back cast. Before you come forward, stop that rod. We all want to look cool. Just come back and go right forward because it kind of looks like you're cracking a whip and you look really cool doing it and your accuracy sucks. Because when you come back on your back cast, your lure or your bait is swinging one way or another. And as you go to throw it forward, it's already off to the side. It's not going to cast straight. Bring your rod back, pause, let the bait, the lure, whatever it is on the end of your line, settle, and then throw pointing with your thumb. That will get you over what you need to get. I mean, I've won a lot of tournaments that way because I take an extra second or two to pause that cast because I don't care if I look stupid. I'm going to look stupid if I'm just standing there. So what
Robert
do I care?
And I would both vote yes.
Yes.
On that.
Okay. And if you've seen me lately, the worse I look, the better the store looks. So I don't know if I'm changing it. I'm getting the, you know.
You got a good point there.
Yeah. The store looks awesome. I look like hell.
The more homeless you look, the better the shop looks.
Exactly. The more homeless I look, the better the shop looks. But pause at the top of that cast, and then you can pitch it out and get where you need to be.
You get better distance, too, because you're loading the rod. If you watch somebody do that, where they pause for a second as everything comes back, the rod bends in the opposite direction. You know, it's
right.
Bending away from you. Now that rod is loaded. When you pull it forward, you're going to get more snap, more whip with it. And again, if that thumb is on the top of the rod, it's going to go straight over the top, and you're going to get the best distance that you can physically get for you, the person.
And when you start, just use your wrist. Do not let your forearm move or your bicep move. Just start this by pointing with your thumb and using your index finger. As your index finger comes off of the line, if it's up in the air, the line's going to go up in the air. If it's pointing right down at the water, it's going to go to the water. If it's going straight ahead, it's going to give you that snap straight ahead cast. But as you get with your wrist and your index finger releasing the line where it's going to go, then once you get good with that, then bring your forearm into it. And then you bring your bicep into it. And eventually you can bring your whole arm, you know, sweeping. But if you do it by the numbers, practice with just your wrist, practice with your forearm, practice with your bicep, practice with the whole arm, all of a sudden you're making these tremendously long distance casts, and they're super accurate.
And let me say this too, you're going to look foolish, but practicing in your backyard going for grass grouper is a good thing to do, because you don't have the fishing pressure on you. Now you can concentrate on how it feels, what happens when you move your wrist a little bit this way, a little bit that way. You're making casts. Even if you've got a short, small backyard, it helps to develop that accuracy. Practice. It's like anything. Practice the cast. Because then when you get out with your buddies, you're going to be the one that's dropping it right where it's supposed to be. And they're going
to
be the ones.
And you get to laugh at them.
Yeah, and they're going to be the ones that are tossing it up into the mangroves and, you know, 20 feet away from where the snook was and that sort of thing. So practicing in the backyard is certainly a good thing to do.
And if you're old enough to remember, Bozo's grand prize game. I mean, I think every kid had buckets lined up in the floor trying to practice putting ping pong balls in it in case you ever got to Bozo's, you know, big top.
That's right. That's right.
So practice helps.
Yeah.
Let's see. You got snook, whitebait is going to start really getting up good. Go ahead. Oh, okay, you were talking to me about the time.
Yeah.
All right. I'm looking on the sheets where we're still at, what we still got to go over.
Well, we haven't talked about bass.
Okay.
You know, bass has been pretty good this week because it's warmed up so much. You know, we got so chilly for a little bit there, and then the water temperature started to come back up. There's a lot of fish that are sitting on bed. There's guys that have been coming in this week going, how do I catch these fish that are sitting on their beds? And they're seeing both males and females. So in certain areas, they're in post-spawn and pre-spawn, but they're sitting on beds right now.
So lizards.
Lizards. Plastic lizards. And you can do it two different ways. You can either just put it on a Texas rig style and cast it there and let it just sit. You don't do a thing. You just let it sit there. Or you can do wacky worm style and still the same thing. You know, wacky worm, just hook that right in the center, throw it out there and just let it sit perfectly still. Maybe twitch it very subtly just by rocking it like
what
you've
you
had
do,
too many cups of coffee that
yeah,
morning.
You toss it into their nest, and you don't want to move it out of the nest, but you want to make it threatening to the eggs. So with your line snugly tight, shake the tip of your rod. Don't pull it, don't jig it, literally just shake it a little bit. All you want is that lizard to kind of wiggle just a little bit, like it's smelling or sniffing for bass eggs. And all of a sudden, wham, that bass is going to hit it. And then it's going to back right off, because that wasn't, I want to eat you, that's, I want to kill you. And so that first hit, that's the stun hit. They back off, and then they're going to flare their gills out. They're going to roll to the left and roll to the right. And they're going to look, and they're going to get big and threatening to see if it's still alive, if it's scared, if it's going to back up, it's going to come after them. And when it doesn't move, because now you don't shake it, you don't do anything, you just let it lay still, that bass will grab it, and they don't have fingers and hands, boys and girls, so what are they grabbing it with? Pick it up in their mouth, they're going to go off to the side. Watch your line to go to the side. Once you feel that big hit, freeze. Don't touch it again. Relax. Stay there. Because as that bass is moving it off, that's when you set them up. Sneaky time. Any last words, Robert? We got about 30 seconds.
Nope. Go out there and enjoy the beautiful weather we've got and fish for all sorts of stuff.
Okay. RJ, say goodbye.
Goodbye, no. RJ.
Bye, RJ. Oh, God. Not Rich Little. I can't remember the comedian, but there was one who did that. Anyway, bye, boys and girls. Fishing Frank here. Robert in the chair across from me. RJ, as usual, in the control center. Bye.
Boy, I'm going fishing just to ease my mind.
I knew that's what you were going to say.